This is an interview for the Jackson McKeldin Project of the Maryland Historical Society with Senator Troy Braley on Friday, July 16, 1976. The interviewer is Michael Louis. Senator Braley, what aroused your interest in civil rights?
Well, first of all, I'm from South Carolina, and when I was a kid growing up in South Carolina, I saw the way blacks were being treated, and I vowed to do something about it if I ever got the opportunity. So I left South Carolina at a very early age, and I walked to Baltimore.
You walked to Baltimore?
Walked to Baltimore, and I got odd jobs, shining shoes and waiting tables later on. And then in 1941, I got a job as a Pullman porter. And there I met up with A. Philip Randolph, the person I consider as being the dean of the civil rights leaders.
Well, should I ask you the next question? Well, what specific role did you play in the civil rights movement in Baltimore?
Well, after I came to Baltimore, I became affiliated with the various civil rights organizations, such as the NAACP and specifically the NAACP, and through the A. Philip Randolph on a national level. I worked with him because he was, as I stated, the granddaddy of the civil rights movement, and there were many activities that I worked with along with him. As a matter of fact, I worked with him in 1941 when he had the proposed March on Washington, back in the days when President Roosevelt was in office, and the march was not carried out because Mr. President Roosevelt decided to issue an executive order to create the first Fair Employment Practices Commission, and we accomplished what we wanted without actually having to march.
In what ways were you associated with Stephen A. Jackson?
Well, I worked with Mrs. Jackson. I was chairman of the Labor and Industry Committee for the Baltimore branch of the NAACP. And I worked very closely with Mrs. Jackson for many, many years.
What did this committee do?
Beg your pardon?
Labor and Industry Committee, you said?
Oh, Labor and Industry Committee, the Labor and Industry Committee, we fought for jobs and employment for blacks and upgrading blacks on the job. And that was specifically our job there, going out and pressing for blacks to be hired in certain industry. And back in those days, blacks had very few jobs other than, you know, being porters and maids and the like. And so we pressed for blacks to be employed in other capacities, and pushed for policemen, black police, to be hired. And after they were hired, we pushed for them to be promoted. And I, as chairman of the NAACP, the labor committee, I, and along with Mrs. Jackson, we were responsible for getting the black firefighters in the union. The black firefighters were hired, but the union refused to take them in. And as chairman of
the local union?
Local union, right. They had tried, before they came to us, they had tried for 5 years to get in the union, and they sent in the dues, and the union sent the money back, and we got into it, and was able to get the black firefighters in the union.
That's around what period?
I guess that was about, that was in the 50s.
The 50s.
Yes. We had a pretty tough fight on that because, you know, they, I am a union man, but I still, I am opposed to blacks specifically being discriminated against by anyone, whether it's a union or whether it's a company. Mm-hmm. And when we find that people are being discriminated against, especially blacks and the poor, well, we fight for them. But we were able to get the firefighters in the union. When the union finally decided to accept the firefighters, they wanted them to pay dues for the 5 years that they were kept out. And of course, we were opposed to this. And we told the union that the firefighters would go in for the same initial entrance fee that everybody else had.
Yes.
And of course, we had a long fight, and the union at that time had a real publicity campaign going on, and they, as they hired new firefighters, they had them to come in, you know. And they claimed the other firefighters refused to come in. So we had to make it clear that the firefighters who were going in, because we told them to go ahead on in because they were only paying the regular initiation fee. But the others wouldn't go in because they wanted them to pay this back money, which amounted to about $500 apiece.
Oh,
so we finally, being a labor man and being affiliated with A. Philip Randolph, I took the case to Chicago to the AFL-CIO Civil Rights Committee meeting in Chicago, and met with Mr. Randolph, and we got the support of the AFL-CIO Civil Rights Department, and they helped us, and we got them in the union.
I see. And the NAACP here was
right. Right. It was initiated through the NAACP.
Uh-huh.
Right. Right.
Earlier on, you told me that we were speaking about Mr. Randolph, and he was let me change the question then. What about Ms. McKeldin, the governor? Were you associated with him in any way?
Yes, I was associated with Ms. McKeldin, and when he was first governor, mayor, and I think it was first mayor, then governor, then mayor again. And Mr. McKeldin was an unusual person. As a matter of fact, I think he was way ahead of his time. And he really put his neck out to bring about equal justice for all citizens of Maryland. Mm-hmm. And it was an unpopular thing back in those days. But Mr. McKeldin stuck to his gun. And he just said that he, you know, that everybody should have equal opportunities, and he stuck to this right up until he died.
You think that was a point of principle or political? Or?
I think it was a point of principle, but really it was bad strategy as a politician for him to stick his neck out that way. No, it really wasn't political. But even though Mr. McKeldin, and I think he knew this, even though he was a Republican, whenever he ran for any office, although blacks couldn't vote for him in the primary, but all blacks voted for him in the general in all elections, when he ran for mayor and he ran for governor, he got black support because they knew the kind of person he was, and they knew what he did when he was in office before. As a matter of fact, I created a committee 5-6 years ago to give awards to persons who had done the most to bring about a better relationship between the races in the last decade. And the reason why I thought about the last decade, because we wanted to, in addition to giving awards to blacks, we wanted to give awards to those whites who stuck with us back in the difficult days. And Mr. McKeldin was one of the first persons that, along with Mrs. Jackson, were the first people of to receive the awards. As a matter of fact, they received them the same time.
Oh, I see. When did they receive this award? Is it?
This is in 1972. Right, and we've, as a matter of fact, when I started adopted this idea, it was just a thing that I thought up, and I got up this committee of 150 people, and just a loosely knit committee, mm-hmm. and I went out to one of the large catering places. And I told the owner of the place about the idea I had, and just myself with no money, no organization, and nothing else. And he said, "Well, Troy, it's a good idea." He said, "I'm with you." So with that, he let me rent the room with no money, and let me run up her $6,000 bill and said nothing about it, and with just my signature. Mm-hmm. And of course, the when we had the affair, we honored our 10 people, including Mr. McKellen and Mrs. Jackson, 5 awards and 5 posthumously. Mm-hmm. And we brought together business people and white and black. Matter of fact, a lot of business people and their wives who had never been out with blacks socially. And the affair was such a success until we have continued it, and we've had it ever since, and we've had it each year. I've been able to get nationally prominent speakers to come. That particular night we had Senator Philip Hart of Michigan to speak at that first affair, and we've been able to get nationally prominent speakers ever since.
What's the name of the award? Did you?
It's just called the Citizens Award Dinner Committee.
I think I heard of it. Yeah. Okay. Let me just change focus slightly. What were some of the obstacles you had to overcome before becoming a political representative in this city? Can you think back and think of any of it?
Yeah. Well, really, I never wanted to be an elected official because I always thought that, I always played it fair. And when I thought, that I was right about something, I stuck to it. And I never wanted to be an elected official because I always thought that people could, come and twist your arm, and make you do things that they wanted you to do. And I really didn't have any problem because I had worked in the civil rights area so long until I was really asked to run for office. As a matter of fact, well, one of the I was affiliated with one of the 4th District Democratic Organization, and I was asked to run for office 4 years before I actually ran, and I turned them down. And when I ran, I won. And I've been an independent. When I say independent, I do what I think is right for the people. And one other thing, I don't let anyone, black or white, put money in, just say that, you know, give me money for a campaign. I don't take it. So I'm independent. You see, when you take money, and I say take money when I, you know, when people support you financially, yes, let's say, then, you know, they can pressure, you know, about on certain bills, you know, if, even if the bill is for the people, and there may be others who don't like the bill, you know, they may try to pressure you. I know the first year I was there in 66, I passed the first minimum wage bill. And I remember the Chamber of Commerce was opposed to this. And I'm told that the next time I ran, they were opposing me, but I won.
What I was trying to get at is the nature of the black power structure here in Baltimore at the time. You know, for instance, well, did anyone control it? Was there a black power structure, a political machine that somebody controlled?
Well, they were.
How powerful were black politicians at the time? Let me put it another way.
Well, the black. Well, at the time I ran, the black politicians were, I can't say how strongly, you know, they were at the time, but I do know that the organization I was affiliated with at the time was, they had people from, it was a black organization, but they were people in there from different persuasions. And I do know that when I ran for office, part of the people, they let somebody, whites, come in and divide the people who were originally on the ticket to run, to support one candidate for governor, and some support the other. And we started out that way, and I had some of my former good supporters going against me because I wouldn't go along with the idea of splitting the black community, but I still won.
Would other black organizations, say the NAACP, have opposed you if you had expressed too radical an approach? Do you think so?
I don't quite understand what you mean.
Suppose a black politician were to be very radical, probably. Would the NAACP have opposed them?
Well, I think back in the days of...
Like that kind of radicalism that came later on, for instance.
Well, I think back in Mrs. Jackson's day, I don't know anybody who was any more radical than she was. I mean, she was, you know, she didn't preach the idea of hating white people, you know, if that's what you're talking about. But I don't know if anyone was any more radical than Mrs. Jackson, because she was truly a warrior, and I know she would get on that telephone, and she would call those big white people downtown, and she would call everybody, and she would just stay on that telephone until she got an answer. Now, sometimes she would talk so long, and I've known people to put the telephone down on the other end and walk around in the office and let her talk, but she stayed on the phone, but they finally come back and give her the answer. So there were no one back in Mrs. Jackson's day any more radical than she was, because she was truly in my opinion, a great lady.
Okay, but just turning back to the civil rights movement, I know there were different organizations at the time. For instance, you had the Urban League, you had the NAACP, I think the Ministerial Alliance came in at some point. Which dominated? Did the NAACP dominate the civil rights scene throughout the period? Or?
Well, I think the NAACP and the ministers together dominated the civil rights movement and the labor movement. A. Philip Randolph, labor, black labor, they dominated. Well, you had you had different fronts. You had people who actually got out on the firing line and who demonstrated and sit in and picket and the like, and then you had other people who had to raise money to get them out of jail, you know, when they went in, you know, and so forth. So we had them all working together, and I think one was just as important as the other, because even though, you know, we demonstrated and we did other things like that, you still had to have money, you know, to run the organizations. Whenever you put on a demonstration, you had to have signs, and you had to have material, and you had to have all this other thing, and it cost money. And the other people, well, we had various white groups in the city that supported us. As a matter of fact, when we had the March on Washington, one of the white groups donated their office, the office space, free. And we had many, many white friends with us back in the struggle, you know, the civil rights struggle. As a matter of fact, if you remember, getting away from Maryland, down in Mississippi, you had the Smyrna and Goodman, you know, the two white boys from New York, and this black boy, Cheney. And they went down on the voter registration drive in the South, and they were all murdered in the South. And there were two whites and one black. So during the 60s and the late 50s and the 60s, and we had many, many, many good white friends working along with us in the civil rights struggle.
Was the Urban League very effective at any time?
Well, the first time the Urban League demonstrated a picket or anything like that, it was 1963 in the March on Washington. This is the first time the Urban League participated in a demonstration. Now, maybe I can see their point, you know, because they are part of the community chest. And of course, they get their money from the power structure. And you know, I can probably, you know, maybe sympathize with them. I don't know, but
they were not pushing as they
implicit. No, they were not.
Because some people claim at some point they were at the forefront of the civil rights movement.
Who?
The Urban League.
No,
that's not true.
No, that's not true. That's not true.
Well, I was about asking you how great was Mrs. Jackson's influence on public affairs at the time. But
I think of, you know, I've told you about
that. Yes, that's what I think.
Right, yes, right. She was great.
Yeah.
And she took, you know, Mrs. Jackson, I don't care how small a problem anybody, you know, anyone would have. Now, she was in her office 8:30 in the morning, and she would stay right there. You know, I mean, she was the big chief, but and she had other people working, but she would be right there handling the problem. I don't care whether somebody came in there with a small problem, you know, or a big problem, she would help them. She would help them. And you know, she was just a great old lady. That's all I know.
Yeah.
She was wonderful. And I worked very, very closely with her. And she would call me all during the night. She didn't care what time she, you know, it didn't make any difference about time if she wanted you to do something. If it's 3 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, she would call you on the telephone. If my wife would answer the phone, she said, "Well, excuse me, but I want to speak to Mr. Braley." And that's the way she was.
Do you think if you had to select, say, one activity or one incident about Mrs. Jackson that you could consider, I mean, her greatest act, would that be difficult?
Yes.
She did.
Yes. Yes.
She did so much that you could.
Right. Yes. Very well.
Did you notice any changes in her attitude over the years? I mean, she headed the NAACP for a long time. Say, particularly in relationship to when the militants came on the scene, for example, did she?
No, she didn't change. She didn't change. She just, the only thing that changed her was when she became ill, when she had a stroke, and it slowed her down. That's the only thing changed her. I mean, I never remembered her, you know, actually, she would say that, you know, we need all groups. I just, you know, I don't take the, you know, maybe the same road they're taking.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
I see. Yeah.
But she didn't actually criticize him, you know, but she'd just say, well, we just don't go that route. So, but she didn't actually criticize him. And then again, she had a knack of working with young people. She had a lot of it, like they had the youth groups and all like that. They all loved her. And she was known throughout the nation, and she was known at the NAACP convention. They always spoke of the Baltimore branch and Ma Jackson. That's what everybody called her.
She was known nationally.
That's right. Ma Jackson. And they respected her when she walked through anywhere. You see, she was a very stern person, and the people, you know, the whites who, you know, she would talk to or get after, they didn't actually, I don't think anyone hated her, but I think they sort of fear, but everybody respected her. Everyone respected her.
I understand she didn't compromise either.
No, she did not compromise. And like I said,
yes.
She got on the phone and
yes.
And they would put the phone down and walk away, but she wouldn't get off that phone until she, you know, resolved whatever she went to do.
Let me just ask you, who were the black militants in Baltimore in the 50s and 60s? Can you remember? Maryland generally.
Well, we had, you know, it's sort of hard to actually say. Well, we had a group around we called CIG. CIG, they had two brothers in there, the Conway brothers in that group. And we had another young man here from, that came into Baltimore from Philadelphia. His name was, escapes me right now. I can't think of his name. But you know, they started out, you know, as militants, but it seems that a little later on, they got a, you know, a nice little job, city job, or some kind of job, and all of a sudden they went into seclusion, you see. And I think this is what, you know, I gave the some of the local people an idea. On the 10th anniversary of the March on Washington, I was talking to papers, local black papers, and I said, why don't we do something on, you know, the black leaders back in, the, you know, 10 years later, where are they now, you know? Mm-hmm. And you'd be surprised. You know, of course, I know everybody have to live. You can't, you know, can't do it forever, but you know, sometimes you get a job. And then the other thing is we had a lot of people in the black community who criticized the militants when they were out there. But the militants were out there, when I said black, I'm talking about the so-called upper class blacks.
Yes, you're telling me about the black leaders who criticize.
Well, I'm not talking about the black leaders. I'm talking about other blacks in the community. You know, I'm not necessarily talking about black leaders. I'm talking about people who were who got jobs after the black militants went out and they demonstrated and they pointed out the injustices and so forth. And the same people who criticized these people who said, you know, pointed the finger and said, oh, he's a militant and he's this and he's that and he's the other. But at the same time, when the when they broke down the barrier of discrimination and they started hiring people and big jobs and all, they didn't hire the militants. They hired those blacks who were back here criticizing the militants. They weren't necessarily the blacks I'm talking, weren't necessarily in the civil rights movement. They were, you know, they figured they were secure and so forth. But let's say, for example, some person, you know, maybe he was a teacher or something. And then they said, well, we want to put a black in a high rank, a high job. Well, they'll come over here and pick this guy. They're not going to hire the militant who's out there demonstrating. They're going to come over here and pick a guy who's over here is doing something else, who wasn't a part of the whole movement, you see. And as I stated, a lot of the people who were standing back and criticizing really, you know, reaped the benefit of the struggle of the militants.
Do you think this brought about the decline of the militants?
Yes, I think it brought about a decline, and I think at the present time, I don't know whether we're coming to a climax in this interview, but you know, there's not much action going on now in the civil rights struggle. As a matter of fact, the many black leaders, such as Jesse Jackson, who's saying that we've achieved all of our civil rights. Now we should strive for silver rights. Well, I agree. I think the two go together. But in my opinion, we have not achieved our civil rights. Consequently, it's hard, you know, to get people now to, you know, blacks to take out an NAACP membership. And they're not talking much now about the struggle, you know. They're saying we have it made, you know. And being in the labor movement and seeing all these people unemployed and being discriminated against in plants and the like, and looking at the school situation up in Boston, the civil rights struggle is not over. You can talk about civil rights, which we have to have, but if a man is discriminating against you down there at the plant, you see, and you don't have any pressure. You got everything that we have. We've achieved, I think we've achieved quite a few things, but
everything that we've achieved came about through pressure. We haven't been given anything. We fought for everything that we have at the present time.
Yeah. What do you think explains the lack of push in the civil rights movement in Baltimore in the late 60s and up to now, to this period?
What is that?
Right here in the city.
The lack?
Yeah, the lack of push that it had seen in the 1950s. What do you think?
Well, first of all, you know, Mrs. Jackson passed on. That's one of the things. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, have made good. Even, you know, whether they made good or not, they've been able to, you know, get a big mortgage and buy a big house out in Columbia, you know. And they've come out from among them, so to speak. You see, in a, you know, you don't, you're not, you have a job downtown now, you're teaching, and you live in Columbia, or you live in Baltimore County, which I don't blame anyone from better air conditions, you know. But I don't think, you know, that you should forget about from whence you came. You see, I'm living good, you know, but you're in the minority. The majority of the blacks are still living down in the ghetto, getting set out in the street, you know, because they can't pay their rent, you know. And you know, we don't see this because we're coming around the road, you know, we're coming over the expressway coming into town, you see. And even though we have relatives back there, even some of our teachers, black teachers now are saying that they have to go, you know, they've been out of ghetto about 3 years, and they have to go to special schools in order to learn how to teach ghetto kids. You see, we are so far removed, you see. So, that's our problem. That's our problem. I'm glad to see the these athletes and so forth pulling out of from the African countries, pulling out of the what do you call it up there in
Montreal?
Up in Montreal. I'm glad to see them sticking together, pulling out. Mm-hmm. You see. Because in order to accomplish anything, you have to stick together. And I think at the present time, the civil rights movement is at a standstill.
Because of the same fragmentation.
Fragmentation plus a large majority of the people feel that, you know, blacks, you know, feel that they haven't made it. You know, plus we have some of the black leaders saying that we don't need the civil rights movement anymore. You know, but we still need it and we still have to have it.
We haven't spoken about, say, the Afro, the churches in the 1950s, 1960s. What were the attitudes?
Afro newspapers?
Yes.
The Afro newspapers were very active. They were active in the civil rights struggle. As a matter of fact, I don't know what we would have done without the Afro-American newspapers. As I stated before, that the Afro-American newspapers have been and still is the backbone of the black community. I know that Mr. Carl Murphy former chairman of the board, worked right along with Mrs. Jackson all through the civil rights struggle, using the Afro and helping the NAACP and all of the movements that we've had. They've joined right in with us and just given us 100% cooperation. So we couldn't have done it without the Afro.
It was the whole cooperation.
The whole cooperation with Afro.
Now, let me ask you this. We know Mrs. Jackson was doing a lot of work at the time. But did anybody at the period ever criticize her? Was it dissatisfied?
Oh, certainly. Some people criticize her, yes. You know, you can always be criticized. They criticize Christ, you know. And certainly some people criticize her. You know,
was that among black people or among white people?
Well, it was, you know, some blacks as well as whites. But as I before stated, you know, a lot of people criticize you for doing good.
Yeah. Yeah. What I'm trying to find out is, were there people with different views at the time? You see, for instance, the black persons who would criticize Mrs. Jackson. Well, what would they want, or what would they have thought would be the right thing to do?
I don't know of too many cases where they, because they always look to her, you know, for leadership. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think you mentioned earlier about the churches.
Yes.
Mrs. Jackson depended upon the churches to help the NAACP, you know, exist. And the NAACP had a very good, very good relations with the churches during during Mrs. Jackson's time. They always had a minister as vice president of the NAACP, and they would always have the local drives, and the churches would, you know, help the membership. As a matter of fact, were it not for the churches, the NAACP could not have existed financially.
The churches give the financial.
That's right. That's right. That's where they got their financial support from, churches. And of course, the colleges, the black colleges, they had persons in charge, like at Morgan College. They were very faithful, and of course, to a smaller degree, some of the other colleges, and of course, through the labor unions and fraternal groups. Well. We all, you know, also received help, but the churches were the old standby.
What would be the attitude, now that we've brought that up, of say the man, what we would call the man in the street, to the NAACP at the time? Would they be willing to contribute? Did the NAACP reach them the way that the church could have reached them? I mean, because I think that these were the people who would contribute to the church, so the church would have the funds, so is that correct?
Were you talking about a man in the street?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, one thing, we, we have a very good person presently, heading up the NAACP, but, you know, an organization like the NAACP, and to get people to support you, you're going to have to make some noise, you see. And you're going to have to, you know, let people know what you're doing. Now, the NAACP is still doing a good job, but They don't say much. And when you're not saying anything, or you're not saying very much, then the people don't think you're doing much. And then a lot of people say, well, why should I give to that NAACP? They're not doing anything. That's simply because they don't hear what you're doing. Now, Ms. Jackson made it known.
Oh, I see.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, she made it known.
She reached us.
Right. She made it known what they were doing. And now you take, for example, if someone come to the NAACP now with a problem, well, the NAACP would go ahead and, well, take it to the board, and they say, well, let's take it to the board and let's see whether we should get into this or not. But Mr. Jackson would just jump into it head over heels, you know, and go ahead on and do it, you know, and write and plus call the papers, you know, you see. And you would get it done much easier that way.
She avoided the red tape, you say.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right, you see. And of course, maybe eventually now that, you know, the maybe we'll solve it right away. But the general public don't know this. Mm-hmm. You see. They don't know that you've settled this problem. So you have to let people know what you're doing. And I think this is one of the reasons now, at the present time, we're not getting the support that we should get.
And you're saying it's because people don't know what's going on.
Right. Right. Plus, you know, as I stated earlier, some of our national black leaders are saying that, you know what I mean, we have all of our civil rights and, you know, we don't need the NAACP mm-hmm. or other civil rights organizations.
Let me ask you a question, not very related to what we've been talking about. Was there a communist party in Baltimore? Was there ever?
Well, I don't know of... there were people around who they said, you know, back in the struggle, they were people in the communist party. You know, they would try to get in the civil rights movement, but we were able to, you know, they never got a foothold, so to speak. And we were able to, you know, to spot them out, more or less.
So what was the attitude of the NAACP to people they thought were communists or communist?
Well, they, if they found it out, if they, you know, they just wouldn't let them participate. We had one white fellow around here one time who was very active. He tried to be in the civil rights movement, and, it was alleged that he was a communist. And, of course, you know, we just kept him on the outside. And there were some blacks who we heard that were members of the Communist Party. Although I had, I'm national vice president of the Afro-American Labor Council, and we had some people in that organization who were alleged to be communists. And we had a section in our bylaws. Where you know that's specifically stated, you know, talked about communists would not be admitted, and I just simply wrote a letter and cited that article of the I didn't call them a communist, you know, but I just cited the. I said, you can no longer be a part of this organization because of Article so and so of the of the Constitution. And, you know, you can do whatever you want to do about it.
Mm-hmm. Are these people around still in Baltimore?
Some of them are still around. Yes.
Would you like to name names? I mean, is the
no,
kind of thing that I mean, it's the kind of thing that probably one would like to speak to them and find out their views.
No, I wouldn't like to name any names. They're still around. I'll tell you, you get around If there's a demonstration, if you see a demonstration, like a march or for demonstrating for labor. Now we have a group here now who's very, you know, they're getting to be very active, and they call themselves the Labor Party, Labor's Workers Party.
Yeah.
Now, people say they're, you know, on the borderline, but they don't just altogether call them communists, but they say they're on the borderline. But they're very active, and of course, you see some of these other people, if you have a demonstration, they're giving out this literature and all this kind of stuff. You know. But I think this Workers' Party, they confuse blacks when they and the community in two ways, because they come in and the old thing they talk about is jobs and all this kind of stuff. And quite naturally, people are unemployed, and you know, they can sort of brainwash them, and then they're doing this, and then they're white, and the people say, well, these are some good whites, so we're trying to, you know, help blacks and help them get jobs and all this kind of stuff. So they serve in two purposes.
But generally speaking, you'd say now, blacks have not been too attracted by communists.
No.
Now, just coming around to something we spoke about a minute ago. What would you describe as Governor McClellan's contribution to black people in Baltimore? How would you?
Well, I think he was against, he was always opposed to the death penalty, which we just passed in the legislature. He was opposed to this. And of course, a lot of the policemen used to get mad with him because he said he was too, well, at that time, you know, most of the people they were, you know, locking up were blacks. And they were saying that he was too soft on crime, you know, because, you know, he felt that people should get equal justice under the law. And he was for integration. And when he was mayor, I brought case in against the matter of fact, I asked the city and the state to stop doing business with a certain company downtown who, you know, that sold office equipment to the city and the state, and they refused to hire blacks other than in porters and maids and, you know, shipping clerks and things like that. And I asked the governor, and I asked McClellan particularly, to stop doing business with this company. And he asked the Community Relations Commission, you know, to take over, and they went right in, and they went in this company and told them that they would not do business, the city would not do business with them if they didn't. Of course, you go down to the place now, they have quite a few blacks, and as a matter of fact, I was in there the other day, and I saw black people working, some ladies, they were up front, you know, and I went down there one day, and they were there, you know, and I had to go back to pick up this thing the next day, and I took some correspondence that I had, you know, way back, and when I went back to pick up my thing that I had purchased, I said, read this letter, you know. Yeah, they read it, they came back. They were shaking their heads. I didn't know this. They thought they had gotten a job on that mayor. And they thought the company had always done this, you see. But they didn't know that somebody way back had pressured, just like I said, we have never gotten anything until we pressured. When I went to the man and told him, you know, and they said they didn't believe me, you know, that no one had said that they were discriminating. You see, they were selling to all of the black churches, all the black lawyers, and all the black doctors, and all of this was buying the office equipment from them. And of course, when I told them, they really hadn't realized, you know, that they hadn't thought about it until I brought it up.
Is that recent, fairly recent? Or?
That was in
the 60s?
That was in the late 50s.
Late 50s.
How did
you think the racial question, advancement of black people, should be achieved? I'm saying, did he look through it through employment or through education or through housing? What was his idea of how black people ought to make progress?
Well, I think he wanted the blacks, you know, to be in the mainstream. But, you know, he had some obstacles, you know. You know, being mayor, our governor, and when you come in and you have new ideas, mm-hmm. and you have all of this old people who've been in office and old for a long time, it takes you a long time to get your ideas over. Mm-hmm. And you have to cut through a lot of stuff to... It takes you more than, I guess, two terms to really implement the things that you have in mind to do. But he was able to do quite a few things. I think he really wanted blacks, you know, to be in the mainstream.
Was he opposed by any local white politicians because of his stand on civil rights? I mean, McKeldin. Were there any clashes with him?
Oh yes, they had clashes with him, right? But it didn't seem to bother him. On the other hand, he was very close to the Jewish community also. He used to he used to go around and speak on bonds for Israel. And he was one of the best money raisers the Jewish community had. So he was very close to the Jewish community as well as the black community. So he had a pretty good base.
Okay. Well, now that you've told me that, what was the kind of relationship between the Jewish and the black community? Can you remember?
Well, we had a good relationship between the Jewish community and black community. The Jewish community, as a whole, they supported us in the civil rights struggle. Although, you know, we had a lot of, well, that's one of the things that, during the riots, we had a lot of people, they destroyed a lot of the Jewish stores, saying that they were cheating people in the black community and so forth and so on. But on the other hand, I think they helped a lot of people because, I don't care. You know, if you live in the inner city, and even though, you know, a lot of people said that they were being cheated, people had to trade on the books, you know, and they had to, you know, go to the corner store they weren't able, you know, they didn't have cars and all of that. Could go way out somewhere. They didn't have, you know, supermarkets all around and the shopping centers like we have now. And they had to go to the, you know, to the Jewish stores down on the corner, and they would let them have things when they didn't have money. And on a whole, the people in the black community, thought that they were, you know, that they got along, you know, well with the Jewish people. And in the civil rights struggle, we had the Jewish people really, really stuck with us. They stuck with us in the civil rights struggle.
I'm going to ask you just about two more questions. Can you tell me, how effective would you say are the present black politicians in the civil rights struggle? How effective can you bring your pressure to bear, knowing in many cases you might be in a minority in the House?
I think you can be very effective. We have the Congressional Black Caucus and in Washington, and we have the 19-member Black Caucus and the Maryland Legislature. Now, we have to realize that some of the blacks may be tied to, let's say, if something would be coming up that, you know, affect the mayor, to affect the governor, something like that, and you would want all of the black politicians to, let's get together and take a stand. I don't know whether you get a solid front or not. But if the black politicians were to stick together, 19 people would have a very, 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 quite a bit of strength. Now, for example, there were a lot of talk, well, you take in the legislature right now, most of the counties are anti-Baltimore City. Now, if there's something for the city, you know, most everything that come up, all of the bond issues have to be cleared through the whole legislature voting on by the 23 counties. So anything that's coming up for Baltimore City, it seems that the majority of the county legislators are opposed to it. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. Now, if the black caucus